This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. This week, the latest annual surveys of public trust in the news say it's slumped again. Is that just a perception, though, or an actual reflection of reality? We ask a couple of editors. Is it a big deal for them?
And when you spend 30-odd years in a career and that's what people think of you, I think it is a bit distressing.
But first, it was a closely guarded secret until it was announced earlier this week. News Hub's 6pm bulletin, confirmed for closure last week by its owners, has got a lifeline, but not from another broadcaster.
Another day, another news staff meeting, this time two locations, two organisations, to announce a slimmed-down lifeline for News on 3. Under the deal, News Hub Live at 6 will be replaced with an hour-long weeknight bulletin, half an hour at the weekend, produced by New Zealand's largest news website, Stuff.
That was News Hub's business correspondent Simon Shepherd, who's been working overtime lately, rushing from broadcaster to broadcaster, reporting on the developing demise of jobs and TV news programmes, including, potentially, his own. But on News Hub at 6 last Tuesday, he had what seemed to be some better news, though not for everyone at News Hub, as the host Mike McRoberts made plain right at the start.
News on 3 will go on, but not as viewers know it. Warner Brothers Discovery has struck a deal with news website Stuff for a nightly TV bulletin.
But details at this point are scarce. What it will be called, how many people will work on it, and what studios it will use are all yet to be finalised.
What is known is that most News Hub staff will still lose their jobs.
And the owner of Stuff, Sinead Boucher, couldn't say how many of them will work on this new news production, though she did say it will probably be fewer than the 40 to 50 that News Hub's own staff had suggested in their own pared-back survival proposal, which was rejected by their own owner, Warner Brothers Discovery. Now, the Stuff deal that was unveiled on Tuesday was done with high secrecy. Even on Monday night, Stuff staff Media Watch spoke to didn't know there was an announcement coming up the next morning, which Sinead Boucher first made to her own staff in front of a banner proclaiming a new future for the 6pm news. But while this deal was clearly done quickly, at that joint media conference, Warner Brothers Discovery boss Glenn Kine presented it as high strategy with a corporate buzzword or two in the mix.
Well, I think this is the future of media, seeing this sort of innovation and partnership come together on how we work together. I mean, it's been well written around the challenges, obviously, in the media landscape. Scale is important, and you know, we were just, in fact, having a direct conversation about the importance of scale, and that can come through partnerships like this. So we're very excited about the innovation and future opportunities this will bring both companies.
But whatever viewers get at 6pm on 3 from July will be a much smaller scale than News Hub at 6 is now. And this is brand new territory also for Stuff, whose core business used to be newspapers, and it's never been a broadcaster before. But that's not a problem in these digital days, Sinead Boucher told that joint media conference.
And we are already a digital-first multimedia company, so we are building off that to produce a modern, new 6pm product for Warner Brothers. So we are definitely not, you know, we're not going into linear television, we're not taking over a television operation, it's definitely not that.
But as for not being in the linear TV business, well, oh yes you are, former TV3 News chief Mark Jennings told RNZ's Ingrid Hipkiss the next day.
But this is the television business, isn't it? It's a 6pm nightly televised bulletin.
Yes, it totally is the television business. And it's linear television, which she said she wasn't getting into. Yeah, no, she's not starting a TV station, but she is providing a linear TV product.
Stuff's own political editor Luke Malpass then pointed out this isn't a rescue of News Hub, but the end of it and an entirely new proposition.
Stuff will now have to properly resource its newly acquired TV contract with the right mix and quantity of bulletin producers, while also trying to get the most out of its existing newsrooms and journalists that have considerable reach around the country. The extent to which the company gets that mix right will be the key to both the editorial and commercial success of the new proposition.
And that's true, though the size of the confidential sum that Warner Brothers Discovery will pay Stuff for the service may be the most important factor in that. And there's also a major contradiction here. What both parties hailed as a major innovation and a pointer to the future is actually creating another version of something viewers have had for decades in the past, a 6pm news hour presented live, just done cheaper by far fewer people. Sinead Boucher also described it as an exciting opportunity for the Stuff staff in 19 locations around the country. But on Morning Report, Mark Jennings pointed out those people already have demanding jobs.
Stuff reporters will be doing that, plus their own job, and possibly writing something for their regional newspaper as well, if they're in one of the regions. Multi-platform work like this is very, very difficult. Just ask the journalists how hard it is. So it's all, you know, you can sit in an office and say, yeah, we've got the capability of doing this. Yes, they have, but they'll burn through the journalists trying to do it.
And Stuff's digital transformation, now led by a new tier of executives, mostly recruited from other media companies in the past 2 years, has already burned through a fair number of journalists in recent years. Though, as we've heard lately, there will be many broadcast journalists and program makers now looking for work pretty soon. Now, these days, Mark Jennings is the co-editor at newsroom.co.nz, and on his own site this week, he said that while a slimmed-down news service on 3 is better than nothing,
it is hardly strengthening our democracy or media plurality. Rather, it's a step in the stuttering rationalisation of New Zealand's news media.
The viewers, though, won't care that much about who's actually making it, but whether they will watch this new bulletin is another question, and one that was a gift for Talkback Radio after that announcement last Tuesday.
When was the last time you sat down and watched the 6 o'clock news live?
I watch it every night for about probably the first 20 minutes, pretty much every night. I wouldn't watch the whole thing. It's repetitive. There's nothing you can't say in 15 or 20 minutes. If it was important, they would say it in the first 20 minutes.
But that was about as enthusiastic as most of News Talk ZB's callers got about the new nightly news.
I mean, I'm a boomer myself. I'm 72. And I used to sit down and watch it. But now I'll either record it like you on Sky or I'll stream it, because those are very convenient ways of doing it now. But I rarely will watch it at the time.
Yeah.
And amongst the ambivalence like that, there was plenty of discontent and claims of bias.
Stuff's going to pull that even further left, and it's going to turn even more people off. So I've been going to watch it with interest. I probably won't watch TV3 because I like a bit of balance in journalism. Mm. That's why I listen to News Talk ZB. But I think the fact that they're very, very left to centre, their journalism bias is going to come to the fore very, very quickly.
The caller Don didn't say why he believed that, and he wasn't asked. But that rising, if unfocused scepticism and mistrust of modern media, which we'll have a look at in a minute here on Media Watch, is just one of the hurdles that Stuff's new, not News Hub at 6, will have to face. Later on, another caller called Simon, who said he was in his 60s, said he'd already got rid of his TV, and
I mean, I still can't believe that we've got Radio New Zealand still being paid for by the government. That should have been sold years ago. Same as the TV stations. That should have been sold 20 years ago when it was profitable. But now you'd probably not get a buyer. You'd sell it for a dollar. The biggest problem is we're going to be fed information that you may start going down a rabbit hole of just one person's perspective of it.
If unregulated sources online pulling people into rabbit holes is the problem, well, surely keeping bona fide outlets on the air rather than selling them for a dollar would seem to be a good idea. Now, when News Hub's owners first announced that they wanted to get rid of it in late February, News Hub's chief editor until early 2020, Hal Crawford, told us here at Media Watch that he didn't think any local media company would take it on. And while Stuff hasn't actually acquired News Hub, it has replaced it at 6pm for Warner Brothers Discovery. So this week I asked Hal Crawford, who's now a media consultant in his native Australia, could this outsourced, stripped-back service with a similarly stripped-back budget actually work out? And what might New Zealanders want from a new evening news show under new management?
We've got to consider here that we're not just making one daily bulletin. You actually have to do it 365 days a year. So that's over 300 hours of news every year. And you've got to be able to cover that roster. That requires bodies. You also have to divide your cost up into OPEX and CAPEX. So CAPEX would be, say, the setup cost, which will be considerable. So the cost of the studio, the infrastructure that's required, and then the OPEX is what it costs you to run it every year, including the costs of the licensing deals. They won't be able to simply take those over. They'll have to re-ink those deals if they want the same kind of access to international news. What's the nature of the studio and the set? And is there any provision for specials? Certain extraordinary things happen, and if you cannot respond to those in appropriate ways, it doesn't feel like you're actually a news service. For example, you have a Kaikoura earthquake. you need to be able to respond to those or you're not actually a news service. So I really thought about a minimal viable product. And I think you're talking about 25 to 30 people. And I think that you're talking about $3 to $3.5 million OPEX in a year.
Do you think, though, that that will be enough to make something similar to News Hub at 6 that would replicate that kind of viewing experience people have now and be relatively similar to the better resourced, you know, TVNZ One News at 6? Or do you think they're going to go for something that is quite different because they're going to have to reduce the ambition?
I think the best thing they could do here would be to try to do something different. And we might see some really big innovation here. The kinds of big decisions that they'll have to make are, you know, what does the set lot look like? How many camera operators, how many reporters in the field? What's the nature of the crosses? How much live material? The relative weight of things like sport in the bulletin.
What about your quite bold idea? Say, look, forget the weather. Let's, you know, people can go to the Met Service website if they want it. Don't have to be fancy. So get rid of that. And instead, we'll do like a fun quiz, news quiz every day, such as they do online, which is gets a lot of engagement from readers. Would they be thinking about stuff like that?
They well might be. They might be quite confined by the terms or constrained by the terms of the contract because if you are Discovery, you have tied down the contract so that you can be sure that you're going to get a product that holds viewers at 6 p.m. They don't want it to be too different from the 6 p.m. bulletin that they had, but they're also going to be realistic that they're paying a fraction of the price. An hour is a lot of video. Without doubt, there will be quite a lot of packaged news from international wire providers there. News Hub was an absolute master of political TV news. You know, maybe they'll give it their own spin. The great thing about Wellington is it's like a sitting duck.
They've also got the former political editor from News Hub, Tovar O'Brien, as one of their camera
big
ready
asset.
Personalities. Yeah,
huge asset, and someone that they should be and will be making big use of for this product. I'm just fascinated to see what happens there.
Sinead Boucher of Stuff has pointed to the fact they have 19 locations, journalists in 19 places around the country. But is that necessarily an asset because they have recently had to rejig their news coverage, having journalists in other locations cover live news in other ones because, you know, they've had a sinking lid too?
Yeah, it's not necessarily a huge asset. It depends on the nature of the person you have in that place. I mean, say you've got one really great correspondent in Queenstown armed with an iPhone 15, the ability to do a live cross straight to camera with no one else around. You know, amazing. Most people are not ready to do a live cross. It takes a newsroom to teach a young reporter how to do that. Can we immediately say just because we've got someone on the ground in a certain place that we have a presence that's ready to contribute to a TV bulletin? No, you can't. It will be a dog's breakfast. There's something that's really quite important for whether this works or not is the status that this bulletin product and team has within Stuff as an organisation. If it's low status, it will wither and die. It has to be relatively high status within that org.
TVNZ this week put out a message to its advertisers, interestingly saying, we have started a multi-year program of work to transition from a broadcast-focused organisation to a media entity with digital at its core. They've employed consultants to do that. Surely Warner Brothers Discovery, they'll have a long-term goal of thinking beyond linear broadcasting, going online only. Is it possible that this deal they've done with Stuff is really just transitional? It is actually engaging Stuff to do something that'll get them over the hump of going online only when they're not going to pay those broadcast fees anymore, and that'll be that in a couple of years' time?
If this works for them and if they get a good return for the money, presuming that the audience will be lower than it was for News Hub, the price is a fraction of what they're paying for News Hub, and then I don't see this as just a stopgap. It could be long-term. I certainly don't think that decision's been made now. I think it's let's see how it goes. It's a case of let's do this experiment. Let's see if it works. And if it works a bit, then let's do it a bit more. If it doesn't work, let's try to correct it. And if it continues to not work, then let's drop it. That's how everyone should be working with everything. You know, that's just the mentality that you need.
A predecessor of yours is TV3's news boss, Mark Jennings. He said this week the slimmed-down news service on 3, that stuff will prepare for Warners, is better than nothing, but it is hardly, he says, strengthening our democracy or media plurality. Rather, it is a step in the stuttering rationalisation of New Zealand's news media. Do you agree with that, seeing as you spoke earlier about, you know, the fact that the crunch has been coming for, you know, 4 or 5 years at least?
I think Mark is spot on. My primary concern at the moment is not that, you know, another old media company might fall, which, you know, it might. The problem is that there's no mechanism to replace them at the moment. So there's no viable way to start a general news business. Yeah, you can start a niche news business, but is there a viable way to start a general news business right now? I don't think so. You know, no one wants to invest in a content-only media business. It is a uniquely unattractive prospect. So that's the problem. That's the thing that government and administrators should be thinking about. It is not the business of government or regulation to save old media businesses. I think, though, it is super important to think about, okay, how do new players come into this market? Because there are no real viable mechanisms at the moment.
If I think back to 2021, New Zealand On Air engaged you to review the effectiveness of public spending on media. In the course of that, you spoke to a lot of senior executives and editors, in fact, most of the ones that matter, and a lot of them were saying then the sorts of things, you know, you're warning about 4 or 5 years ago. Everyone's just responding now in a hurry. Like, do you think across the board, media companies, government, even the people investing in the media, the ones that are left, they've just failed to foresee this and haven't planned for what we're now having to, or media companies are now having to bluster their way through?
Reporters, journalists, anyone who really loves the media is very good at responding to events in real time and very poor at long-term planning. That is reflected in the wider picture where we've known about the forces responsible, not just for 5 years, we've known about them for 20 years. TV peaked in 2011, 2012. So there's no worth in talking about what should have happened. What did happen is that while profits were still coming in, everyone was very happy to ignore. What was very plain was that audience habits were changing. Now, audience habits are what drive everything. It's been a bit like a slow unfolding calamity, and then suddenly it all happens at once. You know, a bit like that tanker hitting the bridge.
Yeah, but policymakers and chief executives of companies are supposed to put plans in place for this sort of thing. I mean, we even had a government that was saying when we had RNZ, TVNZ merger, solution looking for a problem. There's no problem. TVNZ is a viable company. Now we see they are trying to cut their news programs and all their current affairs. I mean, these things have not been taken seriously, right?
So everyone knew that this stuff was that. Well, anyone who was smart knew audiences were changing their habits. Who has responded to that? Well, I don't think anyone has done it magnificently, but there are people who have done it better. Some people have done it better than others. Government always is going to have a problematic relationship with the media. By its very nature, it has a somewhat hostile attitude towards news media. It is quite strange to regard the government as being responsible for the financial health of the news industry. I don't think anyone really wants that to be the case. What would have been better is to have been able to withstand the forces within your own company, say, that were saying, just do the thing that makes the most money now.
That was Hal Crawford, formerly the chief news officer at MediaWorks until early 2020, when that company owned NewsHub. Now he's a digital media consultant based in his native Australia. And back in 2021, the government's broadcasting funding agency, New Zealand On Air, engaged Hal to review its entire spending of public money on public media here. At that big reveal of the new Stuff NewsHub deal this week, Stuff's owner Sinead Boucher also said she hoped that it would push back against those who believe our media are not to be trusted.
you know, those who would seek to weaken trust in media or seek to undermine trust in our institutions has a really serious flow-on effect to our democracy and everything. So the stronger we are as an industry, the more journalists out there on the ground, the better for everybody, even if they never read, watch or listen to one of those stories. Journalism works for everybody.
But last week, the week in which TVNZ cut news programs and jobs and the closure of News Hub as we know it was confirmed, there was more bad news for our media in the latest annual survey of New Zealanders from the Centre for Journalism, Media and Democracy at the AUT, a further fall in public trust. You can read all about the findings of that survey of just over 1,000 people on the Media Watch page of the RNZ website or our section of the RNZ app. Just look for the heading, Trust in News Takes Another Tumble. One of the authors of that AUT Trust in News report, Dr. Maria Mililati, told RNZ that one thing muddying the waters on trust was that people mix up news and general information.
This comes so strongly in the comments when they say that, okay, I read the news, but I go and check and verify my own facts. And then they say that, okay, and I go and, you know, I check the news sites, but then I go and, you know, verify my facts against my social media expert. We don't know what these facts the people are checking are. So they don't just mistrust the news. They mistrust the information as a whole.
And her co-author of that report, Dr. Greg Treadwell, said this was a message that the respondents in their survey had for the media.
We're getting a lot of feedback from the public that there's just too many opinion columns, you know. So they go to, and we
they
know that.
They want more news? They yeah, want yes. more yeah. factual reporting factual, of factual. News?
Absolutely. Yeah. This is our strongest yeah. message yep. to the media yep. Companies of New Zealand, is that you need to improve the volume of straight reporting in your publications, and they need to be better labelled.
But as we know, opinions also engage the readers more than straight news, so is it actually against editors' best interests in these tough times to cut back on opinion? And if people have more bad vibes about the media in general these days, well, is that partly because they're obliged to give more bad news to the people these days, and they're actually doing the job they're obliged to do? Well, last Wednesday, the AUT's Centre for Journalism, Media and Democracy held a special forum to talk all that out.
Obviously, more than ever.
Our work speaks for itself, is just not enough.
No, we have to tell people why it's good. How do we do it? And why can you trust us? We have to prove that then we earn the trust of the public, for sure. And it's not my turn, but I just go and
work.
One quick thing. Yeah. You said...
Media Watch's Hayden Donnell was there, and afterwards he sat down with two of the editors taking part. Mirjana Alexander is a former editor of the Weekend Herald, and then the Herald's premium content editor who oversaw the introduction of the Herald's digital subscriptions. And she was also a former chair of the New Zealand Media Freedom Committee. Now she's a digital media consultant. But Hayden began with Paul McIntyre, the editor of the Otago Daily Times, which got the highest score for trustworthiness in that AUT Trust in News survey.
Kia ora, Miri and Paul. Welcome to Media Watch.
Thank you.
Paul, why do people trust you?
I think it's because we do the basics right, because we cover the major institutions and we do it in a fair and balanced way. We still have rounds covering health and council and uni, etc. We actually have pages that actually are opinion pages, so they're named opinion pages, so people know they're... I think it's just about doing that basic journalism that's fair and balanced.
Have you had to diagnose the reasons for why the trust has declined 20 percentage points over the last 4 years or so? What would you say?
I think it's a huge and complex problem. The findings from the report are really horrible, aren't they? Mm. And when you spend 30-odd years in a career and that's what people think of you, I think it is a bit distressing. But I do think that in some ways it's not surprising, because actually we've been through a very tumultuous period in our history in New Zealand. There's a lot of people that are angry about a lot of things. Also, though, people are bombarded by information today like they never were 20 years ago. The digital disruption means that people are scrolling through their social media feeds, not quite knowing whether something is from a reputable news organisation or is from someone else entirely. And I think it's hard to process that constant bombardment of information. But I think that there are a bunch of great journalists in this country doing great work for many publications, and that whose quality work deserves to be trusted. I think, though, that we have to show that we earn that trust.
Now, if you say that to people, they'll say you're blaming your audience for not trusting you. You're selling a product that people don't want, they don't like you, you're blaming them for it. We know that it's algorithmically amplified because it's engaging. Is it really the media's fault that it's not trustworthy, or is it the social media companies?
I'm not blaming people for believing misinformation if they choose to. I think it's about how do we get to the place that they think that that is true, because they don't have any reason to believe it's not. It's not as simple as saying the media's shit and there's a, you know, and that's really hard. And we don't trust you because you can't be trusted. You're biased. You make lots of mistakes. You're not covering the news you need to. The media in this country behaves really well, and I think that it's, and I'm really.
But they don't think no.
No, they don't think that. But I also like. But I think there's perception issues, right? And I'm really interested to hear what Greg's research will discover in the focus groups, because what I found as an editor is when I would drill down into people saying that to me and have a conversation with someone, I discovered that they sometimes didn't actually mean what they said. Well, they would say, "But you don't do this," and so I'd share a few links and go, "But we did cover this," and they hadn't read it. That maybe people think there is a bias, but they haven't seen the stories to show that there have been balanced reporting on another side of the story.
One of the things we heard about bias there was that the media is too biased to the left. It's become a point of principle for some parts of that political spectrum.
Yeah, it has. And I mean, I've found even recently with some feedback from some subscribers saying we were going to the left. And a bit like Mary was saying, the only way is really to engage back with them.
Did you agree that was the case?
So I mean,
is it a case of did they move or did you?
Well,
you know?
Well, I think we have introduced other columnists not from the right wing, so would be more left. Some editorials that we've written, they certainly haven't agreed with. We've obviously, as we do with other governments, had a crack at the performance of the government of the day, but they perceived that as we weren't hard enough on the previous Labor government, but we're being harder on this government and we're not giving them a chance. The main thing is to engage.
Did you do these things for the reasons of balance?
Yeah, I think so. And often if you introduce new things to subscribers who've been around for I've read your newspaper and online for a long, long time, they're used to certain opinion writers that they're going to get and will agree with their thinking, whereas we are introducing a few different ideas and also reporting.
You know, a lot of discussion has been about opinion and opinion masquerading as news. Well, most news websites in New Zealand that I read mark their content quite clearly as opinion. But then in a digital file, it's one person's opinion. And there's been some discussion about, well, should we actually put another person's a link to another person's story who holds a different point of view on the same issue within that story? Because to my point before, it is really hard to find content online, but if you are going to a news source and looking for information and you read one thing and you think that's biased, wouldn't it be good to have another point of view on the same topic contained within that digital page so that people could find it easily? Because most people no longer consume the news in a newspaper. Yes, many do in this country, but we've kind of moved into a digital-first news environment, right? So we have to think about how we present our news and our opinion and our analysis online to make it easy for people to understand.
Well, Henry Cook on his Substack blog, Museum Street, was raising this point. People used to consume the news like the ODT, and maybe that's part of the reason why you're still trusted. They consume it in a bundle where they can see the veggies alongside the dessert. Yeah. Now you're consuming it in discrete chunks that are served to you on social media, and you might just see an opinion piece from a publication. And does that contribute to this feeling of distrust? People aren't seeing the veggies.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we were talking there earlier, weren't we, with the amount of information that's out there. You are just getting the snippets, and also you're in a bit of an echo chamber as well. You're often looking for those pieces that you're going to agree with.
We increasingly relied on opinion, especially as newspapers would go sort of directed towards getting as many clicks as possible. Do you think that our increasing reliance on opinion has done some of this long-term damage to our trust? Because I think Henry, again, on his Museum Street blog put it, every opinion piece is a potential reason for someone to hate you.
Look, I don't think it was opinion that was driving the behaviour around clickbait. I think there was a lot of focus on celebrity entertainment to really drive audience in the early days of digital news and where the accusations of clickbait would come. But I do think opinion has been singled out as something that has become a little bit perhaps too obvious, or there's too much of it. I as an editor had turned down comp. I wouldn't run columns for some reason if I thought there was a particularly baiting aspect to it. The best kind of opinion writers make their case, or, you know, state a point of view and support it with the evidence. They don't just rant. When I was at the Herald doing this, and they will still be, is that we try to get both sides of a debate. So here's a debate that the public is really interested in, or here is one perspective, here is another. So I think that that we would try very hard to get balance, but you're going to get one or two at a time, and then it is hard to find any opposing or different views. You know what you're going to get from some commentators because of their own political leanings, say. But I think there are some really good subject experts in some matters who will bring interesting perspectives. And so we were talking in the conversation earlier about, is New Zealand a company and should the government run it or the Prime Minister run it like a CEO? Now, that's been pulled over and debated and pulled apart by many people in the last little while, people from different sides of the political spectrum who are taking opposing sides. But it's a really interesting example of something that has captured mainstream attention, and many people are producing opinion pieces and commentary on it.
What I'm getting at here is polarisation part of the issue here, and that in trying to hew kind of closely to reality,
yeah,
journalists are increasingly alienating quite a large segment of society because your job isn't like another business. You're not just selling them cheese. You're not just trying to make it tasty. You have to be truthful. For instance, if a large percentage of your audience thought that the moon was made of cheese,
yeah,
your job wouldn't be to then reflect that back to them and say, yes, the moon's made of cheese. It's to tell the truth.
Absolutely.
And is that part of what's getting people offside?
It's difficult.
I know that might sound patronising.
No, not at all.
No.
I mean, it's a very hard, tricky conversation because some people don't agree with the truth. And so when you get to this, what is the truth? And in fact, what is that? And how do we do that? Because mainstream journalists are trying to work really hard to do a good job, and some people just will not believe what they say, even if it is the truth. My view is that we shouldn't be then going, yep, we agree with you, the moon is made of cheese. We absolutely should not be doing that.
Exactly, except for then the cheese the moon is.
Yeah.
We'll be saying, why didn't you put my view in that the moon is made of cheese? You're biased against the cheese moon.
Yes.
And that's what we're getting.
And that's where we're at, right? And that's really difficult. And that's why, even though it's boring to say so, I do want to hear what the focus groups say to Greg and his research, because I do think that it's quite fashionable to diss the media. Well, actually, why? So let's talk about it some more in some detail and understand it. And is it going to be because the cheese mooners did not get their point of view represented in the mainstream media, or is it going to be another reason entirely? Because I think that because the public are accusing the media of bias, we should print things that are not true. I don't think we should.
Exactly. Your
probably
job
we're not doing your audience any favours, Hayden, by talking about the cheese moon.
Yeah.
Because it's blatantly not true.
Yeah,
right?
But there's more complex issues within that.
Yes.
But there are some things where you can be pretty certain that the science, climate change, for instance, large constituency that doesn't believe it's true.
Mm. Oh, absolutely.
Every scientist will tell you it is.
Yeah. I personally think, and you call me arrogant, is that it's really important for journalists to be clear on the truth and what the truth is, and you'll never convince me, even though you're very convincing, that the moon is made of cheese. You know, so
during the whole pandemic, vaccinations on the whole saved a lot of people, and now we're getting issues with people that won't have vaccinations for measles because they're believing all that. Now, do we not put the science forward? And that, yes, there are some other scientists coming out and saying, well, you know, those vaccinations were rushed out too quickly.
There have been adverse effects for some people, right? So I do think that that's probably quite a good example, because there are a group of people in the population who were very adamantly anti-vaccination, and that was their decision to make. But there were also people who got sick from the vaccine, or things happened to them because of the vaccine. And yes, we should absolutely report that. But you don't scaremonger about it. You have to report honestly with the information that you can glean about that. I think the ODT is a great example and has done well in the survey because, of, as Paul said, it is connected to its community. And so you must have those connections, right? Absolutely. Sometimes what we report is unpopular, absolutely, but that shouldn't stop us reporting it.
We talked a lot tonight about showing you're working. That's basically explaining to your audience why you made the editorial decisions you did. Have we been bad at that, and do we need to get better?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we've been great at it. And, you know, even in some responses I've given to subscribers this week, you know, you realise that, they really don't understand what actually goes on in a newsroom. But I was describing in some of my emails back to the subscribers exactly how we start a news day and how we go in there, and there is no bias there at all. We are just looking at what stories we're going to cover in the best way possible. Actually, they're surprised when you do go back to them, which is a bit concerning as well, because why are they surprised that we're even answering their concerns? Trying to build a bit more trust. You may never win them over, but at least when they're being listened to.
Yeah, and I'm really happy to engage with anyone respectfully who's happy to engage with me respectfully. And I think that it can get out of hand in terms of some of the criticisms. But I do think that it is easy for people to anonymously make a lot of criticisms of journalists working really hard. We get thousands of comments a day at the Herald on all kinds of platforms. You can't go back to everybody. But as I say, I'm always happy to have a debate with anyone around something we've done or should have done or didn't do in a respectful way. And that's great and important part of explaining our work.
What's the one thing that you'd do if you were tasked with increasing that trust rating?
The first thing I would do as a leader in a newsroom is actually gather the troops together and talk to them about it. What do we take from this information? What can we change? What are the ideas from the floor? You know, like, it isn't just on the editors to think about ways to fix stuff. What else should we do? How do you think, the journalists, the team, we can show our work more, we can engage with our audience? How do we show that we are deserving of an audience's trust?
Paul, you are the trusted.
Still, well, we need to be more trusted, 5 out of 10. Yeah. You know, it's got to be improved. We do some newsroom tours, and it's exactly like Mary said, you know, get the newsroom involved, get people involved. Okay. They probably see us in that ivory tower, and they don't understand what our processes are.
Is it also having a sense of mission and purpose? Because we can be so analytics-driven, we can be so driven by the short-term sugar rush of what is getting clicks at this time that we forget what our original purpose is.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We have to have a purpose and a mission because that's what we're here to do. That's why we get out of bed in the morning. I think we have to avoid being too arrogant. We have to absolutely give people a range of information. We were discussing before that, you know, the news media is part of the attention economy. They are. We are, absolutely. But we need to give a range of information to people. But also we do need to engage. We want to engage with our audiences, so we do have to do content that resonates with them. Some of the readings internationally about rebuilding trust are engaging more and leaning more into the topics that the audience cares about and wants to engage with. Well, that's what the analytics will show you, what they want to, that is what they are choosing right now. But you've got to try and be a broad church if you are a big mainstream publisher, because you do want your work to be seen. But it is really important that the mission and the reason for doing journalism is not lost, and the important work is still done, absolutely.
I suppose we, basically at a broad sheet, we're doing what newspapers did many, many years and have changed. You know, we are covering those kind of council stories and the uni and they're cared about in our community.
God, is the problem just the internet? We just never dealt with it. We just never can't deal with it.
It's absolutely true. It's a totally different experience. When I was the editor of the Weekend Herald, I loved and cared nothing more than putting my entire week's efforts into delivering to people this beautifully created and curated thing that was deep, meaningful journalism, broke scoops, had great entertainment writing as well. But don't we need to be where the people are as well? Like, we can't afford to not be because
it's rough, though. It's rough,
it's
isn't
rough.
It? Because
it's really
the incentive system and the algorithms that drive it are all designed to work against
great trust journalism.
And probably work against what broadsheet journalism or journalism in general.
That great content is absolutely there online. It's just harder to find, and it's harder to wade through everything
and
else that's
atomized
there, right? Yeah, absolutely.
That was Mirjana Alexander, a former editor at The Herald and formerly a chair of the New Zealand Media Freedom Committee, and Paul McIntyre, editor of the Otago Daily Times. And there they were talking to Hayden Donnell at a special forum at the AUT last week, where they discussed, along with other editors, the findings of the latest Trust in News in Aotearoa New Zealand report by the Centre for Journalism, Media and Democracy. We'll be back with more on the media in Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday after 9:30 on Nights with Emile Donovan, and then back again at the same time next weekend with more Media Watch here on RNZ National.